Today's talk will be on case one in the Book of Serenity. Case one is entitled, The World-Honored One Ascends the Seat. Introduction. Closing the door and sleeping is the way to receive those of the highest potential. Looking, reflecting, and stretching is a roundabout way for the middling and the lesser types. How can it bear sitting on the carved wood seat sporting devil's eyes? If there is any bystander who doesn't agree, come forward. You can't blame him either. Case. One day the world-honored one ascended the seat. Manjushri struck the gavel and said, clearly observe the Dharma of the King of Dharma. The Dharma of the King of Dharma is thus. The world-honored one then got down from the seat. Verse. The unique breeze of reality, do you see it? Continuously creation runs her loom and shuttle, weaving the ancient brocade, incorporating the forms of spring. But nothing can be done about Manjushri's leaking. I want to thank everybody for coming here to practice Zen this morning. Last night, I turned on the television, and the news channel was predicting dire events. We were going to be hit with snow and a severe storm, and so on and so on. So, I didn't know if we would even have sitting this morning. When I listened to the news person on the Weather Channel, it sounded like we would be trapped for weeks. They showed the illustrations on TV, the pictures of the front moving in, and pictures of flooding and storms in the Midwest. And so I didn't know quite what to expect. And I thought it was possible I would come here and only a few people would be here. Maybe everybody would be waiting for the storm, or there would be a storm while we were sitting. Long ago, many, many years ago, we had a Saturday sit like this, and it did snow in the middle of the sit quite heavily. And when we came out, we had to dig our cars out. They were actually quite heavily buried in snow, but we did get out. It's kind of exciting, really. One time we had a sesshin, a meditation retreat, and I got to the Murray Grove place and set up, but then the governor closed the highways down because of very severe ice and snow. So I was by myself for 2 days waiting for everybody to show up. Finally, they opened the highways and people came down. So thank you for coming this morning. Something inside you made you get up out of bed and come here. And that's actually quite interesting to me. I too like to sleep. You know, I like to sleep, and when I sleep I like to be warm. I have a big comforter that I put on my bed. And sometimes my wife comes to bed before I get up, which is nice. She's a night owl and I'm a morning person, so I get up at 5 and she goes to bed at 5. So, but every once in a while there's a little bit of an overlap, you know. So she'll come to bed, say, at 3:30, and that will give us an hour and a half. And when that happens, the bed is very warm and toasty, it's very nice, and if it's cold outside, it's hard to get up. So, you know, maybe you were in bed and you were very toasty and warm, and when you stuck your head out of the covers, the air was cold, and it's supposed to snow. And you think, do I really want to do this? Do I really want to get up and get in the car in the cold, dark, drive all this way, you know? But something about, something inside yourself said, do it. Get up, do it. And you might or might not have encountered that something today on the cushion, but I hope you did. There are many ways to think about meditation practice. In Zen, we're very aware of the limits of consciousness, of the conscious mind. This is a mind that is quite important for our day-to-day functioning. You know, basically, you need a self, you need a name, you need a social security number to function in our society, but psychologically too, you need to have a self, you need to be a person, you need to develop as a human being, as an individual, and so on, for your psychological health. This is really quite important. Most people are reasonably successful at developing a self. Even though it's never secure, it's never totally finished business. You know, having a self is a big project for all of us, being a self, and living in our self, self-confirming reality is very much what we spend a lot of time doing. And I do too, you know. Before the Christmas break, I had a big meeting. And I got up early, and I put on my clothes, and I went into the mirror in the bedroom and looked, and I didn't think it looked right. So I woke up my wife, who had gone to bed around the time I was getting up. And I said, what do you think of this outfit? And she said, I don't know. I don't know if brown and gray really goes together. So I ironed another shirt. I got a different pair of pants. You know, I looked in the mirror again and tried to come up with an image that I was the one I wanted to project at this meeting, you know. And so it took me much longer than usual to get dressed and get out of the house because I wanted to look right, you know. And when I went to the meeting, I wanted to present myself in the right way and so on and so on. So, you know, this is something we all have to do, you know. It makes sense to pay some attention to your clothes, to project the right image, to that's part of who we are. I had lots to do the last few days of school. And, I went out to lunch with my friend, Michael. And, I thought very carefully about what kind of food I would really enjoy eating. You know, so I thought we hadn't gone to, there's an Indian place near the Somerset Diner, and we hadn't been there for a while, so I thought, oh, that would be fun, you know. So we went and ate there, but it was sort of a disappointment. So I had imagined a meal that would be very pleasing to me, and then, of course, I ate the meal, and didn't give me as much pleasure as I hoped, and so I was disappointed. You know, this is sort of like ordinary consciousness. We're creating a self. We want it to be acceptable to others. We want it to be a source of pleasure and joy and so on, fulfillment. And there's nothing wrong with this. This is totally human, very important. If you read books on Buddhism, you can sometimes get the idea that it's not important to have a self or that you shouldn't try to be a self. And I think that's quite a misunderstanding. You know, even the Dalai Lama has a self, you know. The Dalai Lama is aware of his appearance, you know, actually, probably when he has to go out into a stadium full of people, he probably checks to make sure his robes are on right. Maybe he doesn't like that color combination, you know, it's not the right yellow with the right maroon. You know, this is possible. Socks don't work, you know. This is possible. I mean, when the Dalai Lama goes to lunch, he doesn't say anything will do. You know, he probably says, you know, I like whatever, you know, I like such and such. I'll have some sampa, some barley. That's good. You know, has a tea, likes this tea, doesn't like this tea. And you know, actually the Dalai Lama is quite adept at performing himself, at being himself, being a self. And you know, people we admire are capable of being competent as a self. You know, when they can present themselves well, they're well-spoken, they're articulate, they're at ease with other people. Those are all things we admire about an accomplished person, you know, somebody who's an accomplished self. And especially we admire somebody who's comfortable with himself or with herself. You know, so if you meet somebody who's accomplished, at ease, sociably adept, and seems happy with himself or herself, that's and if it seems genuine, you know, as it does in the case of the Dalai Lama, then that's an admirable, that's a real achievement. That's a lifetime of work to be a skillfully created self. You know. So I don't want to put that down. And sometimes I think in my talks I have not emphasized enough how important it is to be skillful at having a self. But I think it's something we all have to do. You know, we all look for self-esteem. We all look to others for self-esteem. We all look to others for our happiness. You know, if you come into a room and one of my assistants in my office got her hair cut, a completely different haircut, and she came in and it was a totally different hairstyle and. You know, I didn't really like it, you know, but of course I wasn't going to say that. And I didn't want to even insinuate that I didn't think it was nice. You know, I said, oh, I love your hair. You know, I love that. That's really a new look for you, you know. And I tried, you know, to not have any kind of hesitation or irony in my response. She seemed so happy. So I made her happy. I, you know, got off the hook. I preserved our friendship, which means a lot to me. And so it was a successful interaction, right? You know, being sensitive to her need for approval was really crucial at that moment. You know, she too is trying to construct a successful self. Redesigning, you know, redoing your hair is a real risk, you know, actually. Because you could walk into a room and everybody could suddenly be appalled, you know. And so, you know, she was taking a risk. And I even though I didn't like it the way it turned out, you know, it's not my hair, it's hers, you know. And so I wanted to show her that her friendship meant a lot to me. And that I was giving her like a vote of confidence in her decision. And these exchanges go on all the time and they're very important. And they're the basis, in some ways, of our compassion, because we understand that you know, sometimes we've been embarrassed or humiliated, and we don't want that to happen to anybody else, right? You know, on the basis of our own failures, we can deal with others more compassionately because we can help them to avoid the kind of suffering that we've gone through. So all of this is part of the realm of the self. And it's part of a skillful living in the world of the self. And so I want to say that this is very important. But also, it's not all there is to us. It's not all there is to us. You know, there's something more than that. And in a way, it completes the self. You know, there's like a... If you think about the self, it's like the surface of something deeper. It's like a wave on the ocean. There really is a wave there, but the wave is made out of water, you know? And consciousness is deeper than just the self, just deeper than self-consciousness. And this is quite important to us in Zen, this idea that there's a self, but that there's something underneath the self which is deeper than the self. And when we Zen people talk about enlightenment, we really understand it as the quest for an encounter with something that is deeper than the self. And so, you know, when we think of enlightenment, we don't think of enlightenment, say, as being up in heaven or being in another dimension, you know, like another dimension. Or we don't think of enlightenment as being, we think of enlightenment as being a psychological reality. Psychological reality. We Zen people are very, very interested in the mind. Mind. We talk about mind all the time. In other traditions, people maybe don't talk so much about the mind, but for us it's very important, because we think about the conscious mind as one aspect of ourselves, of our experience. And that's the part that worries about whether brown sweater goes with gray pants, and that's the part that worries about whether I'm going to offend my office mate by not saying her hair looks good, and so on. But there's another part of ourselves which is like under the surface of this self-conscious self, self-aware, self-centered awareness. And this is what we're really reaching for when we meditate. When we meditate. You know, the self is something we create, and it's something we get better at using and putting into motion, you could say. We get skillful at having a self and being a self and interacting with other selves. But we also have all kinds of obstacles in this process, you know. You can find yourself unable to change, or unable to grow, or unable to cope with certain events. And you might not really know why. You know, my father was quite a disciplinarian, to the extreme. And one of the things my father used to do was to physically punish his children in front of other people. So my father sometimes would give us spankings, you know, with his hand. And he would do it right in front of other people. So if we had family members over at the house, like a family gathering, and we had done something wrong, he wouldn't wait to discipline us behind closed doors. He would do it right there in the living room in front of all of our guests. And this was a very difficult thing to have happen to me, you know, because it made me very shy, right? Frozen in certain kinds of social situations. Now, you know, my father didn't mean to hurt me, you know. He actually thought in a bizarre way that he was helping, even though he wasn't. But he actually created a tremendous amount of unconscious anxiety for me, you know. And when I was in school, you know, basically when I would get into certain kinds of social situations, I would just freeze, even as a young adult. When I had to go on the job market for when I had my PhD and I was going on the job market, I went out my first year on the job market, and I went to various interviews with different universities. And I went out on the job market and I didn't get a job. And my advisor, the professor who was helping me, called up the friends on these other committees that had interviewed me and said, "You know, we think very well of Kurt. Why didn't he get a job?" And they said he was so aloof, and he was so reserved, and he was so passive. So they would ask me a question, and I would answer the question, and then I would be quiet. I think I was afraid they were going to spank me. Yeah? You know, it sounds ridiculous, but we carry these things on into our lives. So I had developed a habit of being very cautious and frozen in public settings where I feared embarrassment. Yeah? And years later, I had forgotten all about spankings. You know, I didn't seriously think anybody from Cornell was going to try to spank me. But I was afraid somehow, unconsciously, you know, of being punished if I said the wrong thing or did the wrong thing. Now, you know, we carry these kinds of obstacles with us all the time. And they limit our world in ways we aren't even consciously aware of. And basically, if you just live in consciousness, it's very difficult to liberate yourself from these invisible barriers. Sometimes we know we have barriers. You know, sometimes we know we have barriers. So, my grandfather had a terrible temper. He would just absolutely go ballistic, and he would throw things. You know, he would get so mad he would throw things. You know, and he would say, "I know I have a terrible temper. I've got to control my temper." And the poor man couldn't really control his temper. You just had to duck. But he knew he had a problem, right? He knew he had a problem. This was, you know, in the Great Depression, there wasn't therapy available for people who had no money. So, he tried to cope with this, but he wasn't very successful. But he knew he had a problem. You know, he knew there was something wrong with him, that his temper, his reactions were over the top. But he didn't know how to work it out, you know. So sometimes we know we have a problem, but sometimes we don't know we have a problem. It's just our world is full of unconscious barriers, you know? So, if we live in a world of a self, and we live in a world that is defined by all these unconscious barriers, our life can get very stale and empty. It can lose all of its energy and depth. And this can happen imperceptibly, little by little, until one day, you know, your life is very dry, very stale, and very empty. And this could happen to you when you're 20 years old. It doesn't have to wait until you're 50. And you might say, why has this happened to me? Why has this happened to me? I can't seem to enjoy anything anymore. Or I can't feel really alive anymore. Or maybe you have long periods where you just feel down. You feel blue and you don't know why. You know, there's really, from the Zen point of view, you know, it's difficult to get out of this situation unless you can go below the level of your ordinary consciousness, you know. And the Zen view is that we have a kind of consciousness which is quite a bit more open, quite a bit more connected and expansive than our normal everyday consciousness. And for us, the way to get to that other consciousness, that deeper awareness, is through Zazen, what we call Zazen, sitting on the cushion. And, at first, sitting on the cushion might seem rather trivial. You know, you come in and you sit down on a cushion and you watch your breath. But eventually, you know, if you practice long enough, your cushions are going to seem to you like, in Zen, when we come into the Zen hall, we traditionally bow to our cushions before we sit down. And you might think, why do people do that? You know, what is that all about? You know, they're just cushions, you know, just a mat and a round cushion. Why would you bow? It's not Buddha. But actually, you know, if you do Zazen long enough, you know, you want to bow to your cushions because they are like this door to liberation. You know, it's like, thank God for these cushions. Because, you know, you can be unhappy, you can be very troubled, you can be very blocked, and if you practice Zazen regularly, something really wonderful can happen to you. You know, we all get caught up in these loops, you know, You know, you think, you know, maybe you've been working on something that's just not paying off, you know, or maybe you've had a problem in your family life or in your workplace. And, you know, you just sit around the house and you think about it, and you think about it, and you turn it over in your mind, you know. And maybe it's when you do that, you also feel distress, you know, anxiety or fear or anger. Something feels, you know, somebody did you an injustice, somebody you trusted betrayed you, you know, and you just sit there and you turn it over in your mind again and again. You know, there's, you know, if you come to do Zazen, you know, you can be, your life can feel stale and empty, lifeless, or you can be possessed by these obsessive thoughts, you know. You can be in real emotional distress. Maybe you're just, you know, really unhappy with who you are, you know. And you come in and you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath. And you may have some physical pain, actually, you know. You know, it's not easy sitting this way. And, you know, you're watching your breath, trying to focus on your breath. Your mind is wandering. You're thinking your obsessive thoughts, or you're experiencing emotional distress of some kind. And you just keep going. You come back to the breath, back to the breath, back to the breath. You know, sooner or later, you're going to have this experience like where all the weight is lifted off your shoulders. It's like you suddenly become weightless, right? I mean, maybe not literally, but you feel a kind of lightness of being. It's like liberation. Liberation. You know, I was just, you know, we when we do meditation, we in Zen, we put a lot of emphasis on breathing from the abdominal region, the lower abdomen. When I first started doing this, I thought that was just baloney. You know, my teacher said, breathe from the hara, this dantian, this region under your belly button. Squeeze, he said, this is very important, very important. And I just thought, this is some kind of a superstition. Later, when I was struggling with a lot of physical pain, I discovered that breathing from this region under your navel can give you tremendous intellectual focus, just tremendous concentration. You can squeeze and focus the mind, and the pain recedes very quickly. But I was reading something the other day about what is called the vagus nerve. It's fascinating. But your spinal cord sends messages up to your brain, as you know. But you also have another set of nerves. There's two cords that go up to your brain, basically from your digestive system. This is fascinating. You know, they said that people who have sustained injuries to the spine, like quadriplegics, can still digest their food. Their heart still works, right? All of these functions still continue as normal. And the question is, how do they do this if your spine, which is supposed to be the thoroughfare for information, if the spine is damaged, how come your digestive system continues to work? And they said the reason is that you have these other nerves, the vagus nerves that go up to the brain. And they said, actually, they have discovered that when you stimulate the vagus nerves, it helps very much with mood. And people who are depressed can be treated by stimulating the vagus nerves. And one simple way to stimulate the vagus nerves, the article said, was to do deep abdominal breathing. So I thought that was fascinating. You know, my teacher, my first teacher, Genki Roshi, used to tell me that the human body was like a machine for enlightenment. That it was perfectly designed to get us to the encounter with the Dharmakaya, with face-to-face with enlightened mind. And he used to say this all the time, this is like the perfect machine for enlightenment. I didn't have any idea what he meant, but I'm beginning to understand him now. You know, this whole business about the vagus nerves, when you breathe deeply from your abdominal region, you're actually communicating with your brain through these alternate pathways. You don't have to think about it this way, but when you start breathing from your abdominal region, you're going to find at some point that your stress level begins to drop a lot and that you begin to feel like there's a weight off your body, you know, and the deep rhythmical breathing calms the mind and raises the body's energy. So you know, you can be in great distress and you can sit down on the cushion and you begin to do this deep breathing, and within 15 or 20 minutes you're probably going to feel better. At least that's how it works for me. You know, 15 or 20 minutes of meditation and the problems that were obsessing me an hour ago suddenly seem very unimportant, very trivial. As you're struggling to focus on your breath, you're going to encounter your problems. You know, when you sit down on the cushion, basically, you're going to encounter the things that were bothering you. You know, so when you do zazen, you don't sit down on the cushion and suddenly bliss out. You sit down on the cushion and you suddenly see your problems. So you might have been hiding them from yourself, but when you sit down, you're going to realize, oh, that really hurt my feelings, or something like that, and you may relive those emotions. But if you keep coming back to the breath, first of all, you're going to be stimulating your vagus nerves and calming your mind. But when you're in this focused, calm state, you're going to begin processing these sources of concern or distress. And they're going to begin to dissipate at some point. And you're going to begin to feel very different, very open and energetic. This will happen to you, I promise. And I've been doing Zazen for 35 years. And even though I've been doing Zazen for 35 years, things still bother me. So if you were thinking that after 35 years of meditation, nothing would bother me, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but it's still the case that things do bother me. But, you know, no matter how much distress I am in, no matter how much I might be suffering, I can come into my room or come here and sit down on the cushion, this magnificent, wonderful invention, the cushion, and I can watch my breath for half an hour and begin to feel a great deal better. If you keep doing Zen practice, you know, you begin to encounter this openness that's that is part of our consciousness. It's not part of our awareness, part of the mind. It's not the ordinary mind, the ordinary everyday self-centered consciousness isn't particularly open. It's not, generally speaking, very open. Every once in a while we have experiences where we touch on that openness, and its sources are deeper than the conscious mind. So, many years ago, in Seattle, I was going to graduate school, and I would stay up really late, and I would have to read all of this difficult stuff, and then I would have to go grade papers, I would have to go teach my course and grade my papers, and it seemed like I just never had enough time for anything. I was like a working machine. It was get up, you know, go to school, teach my class, come home, read, 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 read. Then I'd have to write a paper on what I was reading, and then I'd have to grade papers. And it was like this 7 days a week. This situation was one of the things that drove me back into Zen. But even before I started doing Zen again, I remember I would be walking to the University of Washington campus, and sometimes the clouds would part, would clear up, and I would see Mount Rainier hovering up in the sky. Mount Rainier is so huge that it just seems to float in the sky outside of Seattle. And, you know, no matter how burned out I felt, when I would look at that, it would be like an electric current would go through my body. I would just feel so liberated just by looking at that mountain. You know, we have these experiences where, you know, you go hiking and you turn and you see a tree and you just feel like all the tension is dropping out of your body, you know. This happens in Zazen as well. You know, you're in distress, you sit down, you watch the breath, you have this deep relaxation response. And then little by little, your attachments to the sources of your distress begin to dissolve. And you experience this great openness, this great openness. This is, I believe this is fundamentally real. You know, this is really, this openness is deeply part of our nature as human beings, and probably, I would say, deeply part of the universe. You know, getting in touch with this openness is very, very healing and very liberating. You know, Pure Land Buddhism, you might have heard something about this, but most Buddhists in East Asia are actually devotional Buddhists. That is, they pray. They go to the temple and sit in front of a statue of Buddha and light incense. They treat Buddha very much as a being, like a heavenly being or a transcendent being. And this is really quite, you know, this is really like the majority tradition in East Asia. You know, it's a big mistake to think most Chinese people or most Japanese people meditate. They don't. You know, the Buddhists in East Asia go to the temple, they light incense, they pray. What do they pray for? They pray for love, they pray for a raise, you know, they pray for an end to their suffering. And, you know, when they imagine the Buddha, they imagine this heavenly being, right? You know, somebody on another level or another dimension. In Zen, we experience Buddha as a state of consciousness, right? State of mind. And we believe that really what is called Buddha nature, is inside of us. You know, so inside of each person, there is actually a fully enlightened intelligence. It doesn't have to be created or achieved. It's already there. The problem is that we don't know how to access it. This is the Zen view, and I believe it's correct. You know, once you get to that openness, that great openness inside yourself, your distress begins to go away. And sometimes that openness seems simply empty, formless and dark. But it's better than being in distress, right? It's better than being in fear or anger and so on. But if you sit in that darkness, that emptiness, for a long enough period of time, you will begin to feel a kind of energy or a liveliness. You know, liveliness that doesn't have a clear or obvious reason or source. You know, and we Zen people do a lot of meditation. You know, we are in a few weeks. In 3 weeks, we're going to have a sesshin, a meditation retreat, to which everyone is invited, and we do meditation many hours a day. We sit in this openness many hours a day. And this is extremely purifying and energizing. When you get to that place of openness and emptiness in yourself, you're really at the very threshold of your bigger mind, your Buddha mind, this greater intelligence, this greater awareness. And at first, you can sit there in front of that blankness and nothing seems to be happening, but eventually, you begin to feel this liveliness or energy or almost like excitement. It's really like connecting with the energy of the universe. It's like plugging a plug into a socket, you know? And your zazen is like this too. Your daily practice can be like this. You sit down on the cushion and sometimes you get to this place and it's like plugging yourself into the universe. And the more we commune with this other unconscious energy, at least the theory in Zen is that the more we commune with this energy, the more trust we develop in life. You know, we develop this profoundly trusting relationship to the world. You know, many years ago, I've been talking today for some reason that is primarily unconscious, I guess, about my experience in Seattle training with Genki Roshi. And, you know, I had this very difficult experience at that time. I was in my second or third year of graduate school, and I had gotten good grades, you know. I had pretty much gotten all A's. And then I took a course with a man whose name I won't use. I'll just call him Ted. That's not his real name. But Ted was a very ideological person. He had a very clear view of how literature should be talked about. And he was very, very critical of the approaches that my other teachers used. So I didn't really know this at the time. I just signed up because he was teaching Romantic literature. He was teaching Wordsworth and all these great classics of the Romantic period. And so I read this poem by Coleridge, the man who wrote, if you know Coleridge, he wrote this poem called The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, which American kids read in high school. And I wrote a paper on this, and I turned it in, and the professor, Ted, called me into his office after class, and I thought he was going to go, "This is a wonderful paper. You are such a smart kid, you know." He said, "I want you to look at this paper," and he handed it to me, and there was a big F on it. And he said, "I can't pass a paper like this. Your critical methodology is totally defective." And it was like, "What?" You know. And he went through and he just tore it to pieces. So, I guess I was being spanked. I was frozen, and I just thought, let me out of here. So I said, "Well, thank you. You know, I'll think all of this over." And you know, basically getting an F in graduate school is really an F. It means you're out of graduate school, right? So, I mean, he was trying to destroy my career, basically. It was like he really wanted me to become one of his clones, you know. And I did what he was supposed to say, what he wanted me to do. Eventually, I wrote a paper exactly the way he wanted it. I turned it in, and he said, "This is wonderful, brilliant," right? Gave me an A, and I never saw him again, right? But the thing is, you know, during that period, I was in tremendous distress because I thought, well, now I'm going to fail out of graduate school. What's going to happen to me? And maybe I am a stupid idiot, you know, and so on and so on. So I went, you know, I did what I always do when I get into trouble. I went back to my cushion. And I went to the Zen Center in Seattle where Genki Roshi was waiting one morning, and I sat down on the cushion. And I don't believe in telepathy. Let me promise you, there's no such thing as telepathy. If Zen teachers can't read your mind, and they can hardly read their own minds a lot of the time. But I was sitting there in such acute unhappiness, and Genki Roshi said, out of the blue, "Life is impossible," right? therefore we sit. You know? It was like, oh my God, he can read my mind. You know, actually what was probably happening is he was struggling with something, right? You know, if there was something in his life that was impossible, and he just said, life is impossible. It's impossible. You know, when the small mind, the discriminating mind, the self-centered mind tries to figure things out, it just can't do it. You know, it gets trapped, it gets blocked, it gets confused, and it can't work through these things, you know. That's the Zen view. And you know, somehow our lives keep going. They come together in this magnificent pattern, like the weaving of a fabric, you know? The weaving of a fabric. You know, so many times in my life, I was afraid, I was anxious, I was fearful. And now when I look back, it all worked out okay, right? It's like, I wish I hadn't been so worried. You know, if I only known where I was going to be where I am today, I wouldn't have worried at all, you know? But of course you can't know that. As you're going through life, everything seems to be falling apart all the time. It's just one near tragedy after another, right? You know, it's like life is about to fall apart every minute. And it's like, right? And in retrospect, you realize there was this unfolding of events, this natural unfolding. Somehow it all, it's like, it all weaves together like the like a loom, like the weft and the warp of a loom, right? It all comes together. And when you say, why is it coming together? When the little mind says, I would like to believe you, it's going to come together. The little mind says, but I just don't see how that can happen. The little mind can never figure it out. It's always like on the edge of calamity, right? But there's this deeper coherence that is weaving its way across time, right? And when you look back, you see, oh, of course, right? I wasn't in any danger. That wasn't a problem. You know, these were all fears I was imagining, right? So, basically, when you go to this place of emptiness and openness in yourself, you encounter this energy and you develop this trust. Somehow, the world is not destroyed from moment to moment. We don't know how. We don't know why. It should be falling apart, right? If you think about it with your discriminating mind, it's all, you know, and if you read the newspapers, right? I mean, if you read the newspapers, we're going to be hit by a massive storm, and the stock market is going to collapse, and American democracy is at an end, and, you know, and so on and so on. And, you know, the small mind just says, this is it, you know. Where is there a cliff I can throw? Not the fiscal cliff, a real cliff. I'll throw myself off a cliff now, right? But there's this underlying, it's like there's this underlying coherence that we learn to trust through doing zazen. And the little mind keeps saying, I can't see it, right? But when we sit on the cushion, it's right there. You can feel it in your bones, right? You know, it's a little bit like this, you know. I don't want to trivialize it, but I myself am quite a big fan of Bugs Bunny cartoons, and I have been for as long as I can remember. And there's a wonderful Bugs Bunny cartoon where Bugs Bunny is tricking this dog into going into a tree trunk. And he twists, while the dog is in the tree trunk, he turns the tree trunk around so that when the dog exits the tree trunk, he's going to go over a cliff. I don't know if you've ever seen this cartoon, but the dog is chasing Bugs Bunny, and Bugs Bunny goes into the hollow trunk of a tree, and the dog follows him, and then Bugs Bunny comes out and he twists the whole tree around so that the dog is going to exit the trunk and go drop off this massive cliff, which is like the Grand Canyon. But the thing is, the dog comes out of the tree trunk, and he's still sniffing for Bugs Bunny, and he walks and walks and walks in midair, right? And he doesn't fall for a long time until he looks down and he realizes he's not supported by anything, and then he falls. You know, you either are a fan of Bugs Bunny or you're not. But the thing is, you know, there is something that holds us up even though it's not visible. You know, we don't really fall. We fear that we're falling all the time, but we don't fall. And the little mind can't figure out why we don't fall, why it all doesn't fall apart, right? And the little mind's like nervous, can be nervous all the time about this. But when you sit down on the cushion and you enter what we call mushin, that empty state, and you feel that life energy, it gives you trust in the coherence of things. Somehow, in a way that the small mind can't grasp, things are coming together all the time in this beautiful pattern. You know, I have a friend of mine who is celebrating his 40th anniversary. And he was telling me the other day about how terrified he was on his wedding day and that he almost didn't do it. And he said he just kept thinking, this is a mistake, you know, maybe it's too late to back out, you know, everybody's out there, I can't say no now, maybe I can get divorced quietly next week, you know. 40 years later, you know, this was the best thing that ever happened to him. You know, on some level he knew, but not on his conscious level, right? The conscious mind went over and over all of this and could only see disaster. But on a deeper level, there was this trust, and it all has worked out, you know. That's what Zazen is all about, basically, developing this trusting mind. One day, the World Honored One ascended the seat. The World Honored One is the Buddha. So the koan says, one day the Buddha ascended the seat. Manjushri, who is one of the Buddha's disciples, a very deeply enlightened person named Manjushri, and the Bodhisattva of the future, struck the gavel and he said, observe the Dharma of the King of the Dharma. He's basically saying, notice that this is the highest. This is the teacher of the highest truth. The teacher of the highest truth is just this. Right? And then the World Honored One got down from the seat. And you can think, what is this story about? The Buddha comes in, he sits on a seat. His assistant says, notice that this is the highest teaching. And then the Buddha gets off the seat. Well, you know, the Buddha is you. And the throne, the high seat, is your cushion. You know, this is the first koan in the Book of Serenity for a reason. You know, nothing is going to happen in Zen if you don't do Zazen, if you don't put the time in on your cushion. You have to sit down, watch the breath, calm the mind, work through your fears, and get to that empty place. But when you do, there's nothing that can't be accomplished. This is really the path to liberation. Now, it's very hard for modern people to have this self-discipline. You know, there are people who come to sit here at the university, and I'll say, they'll come here for 6 months. And I'll say, are you sitting on your own? They'll say, I keep trying, but I can't. So it's definitely the case that people need a structure to practice. If you are able to practice on your own, very good. You're very lucky. Please keep doing it. But really, please don't ever take for granted what it means to sit down on the cushion. You know, when you come into the Zendo, you really should bow to your cushions. This is really the Buddha's throne. This is really the Buddha's seat. And when you sit down and you work through your fears and you encounter that tremendous energy and you gain that tremendous trust, you are meeting the Buddha face to face. And if you look in heaven for the Buddha, or you look in another dimension for the Buddha, you're looking in the wrong place. If you want to take, want to have a mystical experience, so-called, and you want to have visions and so on and so on, you're wasting your time. If you want enlightenment and you want to be free and you want to experience a bigger awareness of life, richer awareness of life, then please sit down on your cushion. And everything can be done if you have that trust.